Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Glad you're all with us today. It was a big, big weekend of news. If you're listening to us in real time, we're coming to you on Monday afternoon, and especially a lot of news about immigration. We're going to get into that in a major way during the show today. Remember, you can watch us on Facebook Live. Just go to the GPB News page on Facebook, and you'll find us there. We'd really love it if you would leave your comments there. You can also tweet us at PoliticsGPB, and to the extent we have time, we'll share the comments that you post in either one of those platforms. I want to start by saying Catherine Cummings, who has been a longtime fan of this show, sent us a tweet a few minutes ago saying, changed my plans so I could hear the show live. Jim Galloway, Catherine is glad that you're sitting there as you are today.
And I don't intend to disappoint her.
That, of course, is Jim Galloway, the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, whose columns you read on Wednesdays and Sundays in the AJC. He also oversees the Political Insider blog, part of Politically Georgia, at myajc.com. We also have Beth Shapiro is back.
Hello.
At the microphones with us. Beth is now stopped being a Democratic pollster, but did that for a very, very long time.
I haven't stopped being a Democrat, though.
Yeah, well, we know that. I have a couple of times, and you today said, please correct this. I've talked about the polling you did outside of politics. Most of it was for nonprofits, not, as I've said in the past, for corporations.
But that's okay. It's actually the work I did for nonprofits probably has informed me as much on issues as anything else I did.
Absolutely.
So it was just an important part of what I had done over 30-some
years. I just believe in transparency and correcting the record whenever I possibly can.
I like that in leadership.
It's Monday. That means Heath Garrett is back with us. He's a Republican strategist. Best known, I suppose, among those of us who cover and have covered politics for your ongoing work with Johnny Isakson. But you have a candidate or two in this current election cycle, don't you, Heath?
I do. It's great to work with Senator Isakson, the great statesman, but also Chris Carr, our attorney general, and other good folks around the Southeast.
All right. We're glad you're here. And when he came in today, our fourth panelist, Charles Cook, who is one of the top immigration lawyers in the Southeast, I said to you, Chuck, that I was giving myself a Trumpian pat on the back over the weekend for having the foresight to invite you here today to talk immigration. Who knew how
Who
it
knew?
Would blow
Who knew
up?
How it would work out over the weekend?
Thank you very much
Great
for being
to be here.
Here.
Again.
All right, let me start with a headline that we will talk about later in the show. We have said on a number of occasions that we're all awaiting the Supreme Court of the United States decision on two crucial cases involving whether it is legal to set district lines in states across the country for partisan reasons. And the two cases that the court released opinions on today are Maryland and Wisconsin, and they essentially punted for the time being. But we'll talk about that a little later in the show. So let's start with immigration. Jim, one of the reasons that immigration is a big deal this week is we are expecting the House, under Paul Ryan's leadership, to vote on one, if not two, different versions of an immigration bill, right?
Right, and it's hard to see that either one of them actually getting majority support in the House, but they may go ahead with the votes anyway. One of them would, I think, extend DACA by 3 years, but add quite a bit of what Tim Cook and David Perdue have wanted in terms of changing their the national immigration laws. The other one, which is Paul Ryan based, is a little bit it's a little bit more foggy. I'm not exactly sure what's in it and what's not in it.
The Ryan bill, I can fill you in a little because I went out and looked for this. Number one, the Ryan bill, the so-called moderate bill, would provide a 6-year renewable status for so-called Dreamers. But the people who would qualify for protection have to meet certain criteria. They have to be in school, or they have to have completed school, no criminal conviction, all the sorts of things you would expect. That same compromise eliminates some of the family-based immigration categories. Heath, what we have come to call chain migration, when one person is admitted into the country and then brings the rest of the family along. This bill cracks down on that at least a bit. It doesn't eliminate it entirely.
It is definitely, it's a little bit of a compromise between those who want no family migration, which is the current policy, and those who want, you know, total family. So I think it's an interesting compromise. Again, the House is a starting point on this legislation. We have to remember how the legislative process starts. The House is clearly, with the Republicans, going to start out in a more conservative position, knowing that when things get to the Senate, they're going to be moderated by what the founding fathers wanted the Senate to do. So I don't view these as finished products. I'd view these as the beginning point.
I don't think either version addresses the issue of, that rose up this weekend, which is the separation of families.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the leadership bill now does have a provision about that.
It purports to deal with it.
That's exactly right. And it sort of popped up on the radar, as you might expect, given all the hue and cry this weekend, which we'll talk about in a minute. But Beth, it seems to me that if you're a Democrat, there's a poison pill in this compromise measure because it would provide the beginnings of some $25 billion that the president has said all along he wants to build the wall.
And that's just completely unacceptable to Democrats. We already have blown up the budget and increased the debt dramatically. And now we're set to, the president wants us to spend $25 billion of money that no one has said where it would come from other than try to pull it even more from the domestic programs that are rapidly shrinking, and that it's just it's a non-starter for Democrats.
All right. Overshadowing all of that this weekend has been this question of families being separated at the border, children being placed in one facility while their mother or father both are being held for prosecution in another place. Chuck, before we go to the president on this, help us understand something here. There are two different forms of immigration. There are two different, I don't know what the word is, ways in which immigration works. Illegal crossings, coming into the country, say, with your kids
not a port of entry.
Not a port of entry. That's a crime.
It is. It's a federal misdemeanor punishable by 6 months in prison and a $500 fine.
And it has not been unusual for administrations, Democratic and Republican, to prosecute people who cross the border illegally and are caught. Right?
Well, generally, they have not prosecuted people on that misdemeanor. What they've done is prosecute people for illegal reentry. So they've been deported because that carries with it a 5-year prison term and is a felony. So they focus the vast majority of the prosecutions over the last decade, going well back even before Obama, on that. That's been very rare to be prosecuted for the federal misdemeanor because, again, it's a misdemeanor.
Okay. Nevertheless, what the government stands on solid ground, you could say, in wanting to prosecute people who cross the border illegally. It's the separation of the children from the parents that is causing the trouble. But then there's the second way in which people are being detained, and that's people seeking refugee status who come into the country at a port of entry. Explain that.
What's happening there, if you want to take advantage of the asylum laws in the United States, which are enacted pursuant to international treaty, you have to show up at a port of entry and say, I would like asylum in the United States. Perfectly legal to do that. The policy now is you take those people and you detain them, and you give them a credible free interview. What's different during this administration, at least in the last couple of months, is they've been separating the parents from any children to come with them and holding the credible fear interview for the parent separately from that of the child, even though the child may be a minor. That's different from what the Obama administration was doing. They're not prosecuting those parents. Right. But the bigger difference right now is you have Border Patrol agents standing on the bridges coming into the United States telling people who are going to come in and apply legally for asylum that there's no room for them at the inn, go back to Mexico and wait there. So they're actually being barred from coming into the country as they are allowed to under federal law. And what's been happening is they then go around the port of entry and come in illegally and then try to find a Border Patrol agent. And the first thing they do is say, I want asylum in the U.S. And those are the ones being prosecuted.
All right. Heath, the attorney general who established a zero tolerance policy for immigration, fingers are being pointed at him because that policy has led to the separation of children from their parents. Let's listen to some of what Jeff Sessions had to say about that late last week, and then I'd throw it to you to talk about this.
our policies that can result in short-term separation of families is not unusual or unjustified, and it's really a very short period of time. Normally, the adults are only held in custody for a week or two or three before they would enter a plea of guilty for time served and allowed to go home and with their children. Our policies that can result in short-term separation are not unjustified. American citizens that are jailed do not take their children to jail with them. Non-citizens who cross our borders unlawfully between our ports of entry with children are no exception to this principle. They are the ones who broke the law. They are the ones who endangered their own children with this trek. The United States, on the other hand, goes to extraordinary lengths to protect these children while the parents go through the detention period.
All right, let's talk about it, starting with you, Heath.
Well, I think, look, this is a tough subject, but the rule, you have multiple principles at work here. You have the rule of law principle, right? What is the law really doing? Just because past administrations didn't really follow the letter of the law or have zero tolerance, they used all types of prosecutorial discretion because of resources or whatever. It's clear that this White House and this administration decided that in order to move the discussion on immigration reform, they're going to have a zero tolerance policy. They're going to go to the letter of the law here. And he's got, you know, there's some good reasonable points there that he's making, right? These folks have made a very, we have an attractive thing in the United States of America. It's a privilege to come into the United States of America, whether you're coming as a visitor, whether you're coming legally. And what we have now is we have a huge system that incentivizes people to grab their children and try to come across a dangerous trek across Central and, you know, America and to the border of the United States of America. And this administration is saying we're not going to create incentives anymore. We're going to make it very difficult, and we're going to send the message back home, wherever that is, whether that's Central America or South America, that the old system that allowed incentivize you to come here, get across the border, and then be released into the country is not going to be tolerated anymore. But and it's difficult, right? It's separating families.
Well, that's the question. I mean, there are those who would suggest, all right, the country's going to get tougher on immigration. We could argue about whether that's the right approach, clearly. But why do you have to separate children from their parents?
Well, and to come back to an adjective that Heath used, they're making a dangerous trek. There's a reason people are making this trek. They're not just coming because this is a fun thing to do. They're fleeing persecution. They're fleeing violence, particularly the gang violence that the president likes to talk about, back home. And to arrive at the border and then have your child taken from you and sent one place, and you're taken another place, and there are no provisions for the parents to interact with their children. From what we've been hearing, the reporting over the weekend, these detention centers that where children are aren't staffed with lots of people who can provide the kind of love and attention that young children need. And we're talking about infants, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 year olds. We're not talking about teenagers, which would be bad enough. We're talking about young kids in many respects. And to many of us, this is not who we as the United States are.
The children who are being separated, Chuck, from age 4 and up is the threshold. A 4-year-old and up can be separated and put into one of these facilities.
Well, we know there's children younger than 4 that are in these facilities. Interesting article that was published.
How do you know that?
Because not only have you seen the pictures, but that's the reporting that's coming out of that.
Okay.
In addition, you've got now ICE and CBP looking for new facilities to house group kids under the age of 12. So we know what's happening. You can't defend that it's happening. But at the same time, what you have here is a situation where you could have full prosecution of the law. There's a reason we don't prosecute every crime in America. And we don't. We don't even come close to prosecuting every crime in America. We use discretion for a reason. It's also likely illegal, certainly in the eyes of a lot of judges, to use in jail and criminal charges as a deterrence to people applying for asylum in the United States. There's actually going to be there's a lawsuit pending on that right now. So if that's the idea, hey, we want to have a policy discussion, we want to deter people from coming, it's not working because if it's the choice is between your 12-year-old daughter getting raped by a gang or making a crazy, dangerous trek across Mexico and trying to come into the U.S. for protection any way you can, I don't know a single person who wouldn't make the choice to do the latter.
So, Jim, you know, there is...
I do want to jump in here, right? We are conflating a few legitimate cases of asylum with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people starting to claim because they're learning how to work the system, right? They're learning how to work our system. So the White House does have a legitimate argument here that where we used to have X number of cases, everybody knows if they bring their children and or claim asylum, that they're gonna rush the border in that regard. And I think that we have to make sure that we're doing a better job of separating legitimate from illegitimate claims.
Yeah, there's a very, very fine line between removing incentives and creating disincentives as kill the monkey, scare the chicken, or kill the chicken, scare the monkeys.
And we'd argue that our immigration policy is such as it's a tragedy as it is, right? Even before zero tolerance.
But I think that thin line is what's making a lot of people, including Republicans, very nervous. I mean, I was up at 6:30 this morning, starting to hunt around for Georgia members of Congress who are Republican and are speaking out against this proposal, and I could not find one. The best I could come up with was Bill Curry.
Yeah, when we'll talk Bill Curry, former Georgia Tech football.
Well, and let's talk about the actual numbers here. There aren't hundreds of thousands, not millions
coming across the border illegally.
Absolutely not. Not even close to that number.
In a year.
The last year was 300,000.
Okay, I said hundreds of thousands.
Record, you said millions.
I think we did.
Record low numbers. And for these cases, when you're talking about these specific cases, you're talking about 4,000 to 5,000 a month. These are actually not record numbers, not even close to numbers. The numbers are actually very small, particularly when you're talking about a population of 330 million.
All right, let me interrupt, because it strikes me there are two different issues on the table. One of them is controlling illegal immigration, controlling the number of undocumented people who get into this country. It strikes me that we all could find reasons why we want to have better control over immigration policies. That's quite separate from the Trump administration policy, apparently decided upon as a deterrent, because we've heard Stephen Miller, the president's closest aide on immigration, say this. We've heard others in the administration say it, to scare families away from crossing. And it strikes me, no matter how you feel about what you do about undocumented immigrants, that's a whole different ballgame.
Absolutely.
Do you all agree with that? Do we have common ground on that?
I think we do. I think the deterrent that reasonable folks who want greater border security for a whole host of reasonable reasons, that are intelligent and thoughtful and compassionate and caring, are that you're really trying to deter folks from believing that if they just bring their children and they get here, they're caught and they're released, that they get to stay and it's a get out of jail free card, right? That's the thing that we're trying to stop. From its original.
But you make it sound as if somebody makes a deliberate choice. If I bring my kid, I'll be okay. I don't know many parents who would go and try to start a new life anywhere and would leave their kids behind.
I mean, these are we talk about gangs. Gangs are actually funding the human trafficking of many of these people across the borders, and some of these folks are part of that. You know, only 40% of the folks coming across the border. I mean, there are all kinds of security related issues. I mean, these are coyotes. These people are paying tens of thousands of dollars. They're indebted to them when they get here. I mean, there's a much bigger issue than just a few compassionate mothers trying to get across the border here,
the fact of the matter is that the president has made a decision, and Jeff Sessions is fulfilling his vision on this, to separate children. Nothing that Heath says or any of us say about controlling immigration has anything to do with why can't families, why can't parents and children be put into a family detention center?
And what you have is you have an April 2017 statement by John Kelly, I think when he was the head of Homeland Security, saying that this is the policy we need in order to send a message to the people down in Central America to offer that frightening specter of losing your kids forever, and I think Jeff Sessions repeated it in April. So I don't think motive here is in question.
So
there's a literal line to be walked. This is not in effect a policy. Trump administration doesn't have a policy of separating children. It has a policy of zero tolerance of enforcement that results in the separation.
Oh, fair enough.
And yeah. There's another motivation here, right? The other motivation is not specific to the border. It's specific to politics. And how do you get people to the table in Washington, D.C. to actually discuss and debate and then move on a complex, controversial issue like immigration?
Well, and in fact, you create a crisis.
You create it.
Well, and in fact, Beth, that's in what Democrats are saying right now on the Hill. They're saying the president has allowed the separation of children from their parents to force our hand, to push us to agree on a compromise that we would otherwise find unpalatable.
That's exactly what he apparently is trying to do. I think, though, the optics of this are just clobbering Republicans. And I think if we can inject a note of politics and campaigns, which I know you hate to do on this show, if we can just talk about that for 30 seconds, I'm thinking in particular of the 6th congressional district in Georgia. Karen Handel is the incumbent. And I keep coming back to a comment that Sandy Springs Mayor Rusty Paul made on the show right after the elections. Rusty is a good Republican. And he said he was talking about the tectonic shift. That was his phrase. That's occurring in the inner suburbs, Sandy Springs, a little bit of Dunwoody, a little bit of East Cobb, Marietta areas, that was occurring across the Northern Arc among Republicans who are economically conservative, but socially libertarian. And he was talking about how the Republican Party in Georgia is losing those folks on guns and religious freedom. And now we do layer on top of that images of kids being taken from their parents at the border. And that's not good in that for Karen Handel in particular.
It does strike me, we got to get a break in, but it does strike me as we watch the reaction pouring in, we've now had Laura Bush weigh in on this, saying that she finds this policy to be cruel and immoral. It breaks her heart. I mean, this Laura Bush is not someone who got involved with politics very often. So for her to speak out, it's not surprising that Bill Clinton would have, but he did. We've just seen that President Obama is giving a speech, I think, in the American Pediatric Society. He just said Laura Bush is right. And there are Republicans and conservative newspapers speaking out against this, too.
Right.
It does strike me, perhaps, Jim, this has been a bridge. This is a bridge too far. I think it's going to be interesting to see in the week or so ahead. I mean, the president doubled down today, and we're going to play some sound from him in a little while. But I wonder, a week and a half, as this continues to build, whether you can stick with your base and say, good, they support me.
Well, I mean, and quite frankly, I think a lot of his base will support him
on this. Of course.
But you have had defections like Franklin Graham. That was...
Surprising.
Surprisingly. You had the Southern Baptist Convention, which wrapped up its meeting in Dallas last week. They spoke out in favor of humane treatment for refugees and other immigrants into the U.S.
U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops.
Yep.
Yes, so I'm wondering if this is just, if you don't need to be.
No, I think this is part of this. This is part of Trump's tragedy and his genius, right? And all this is tragedy and his genius all wrapped up. He is a disruptor, and this is a classic example of Trump disrupting the entire environment in order to force a negotiation
all right,
on something.
I've got to get a break in. I do want to listen to President Trump. He spoke about 2 hours ago now, made remarks about this policy, and we'll get to that after a message.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. I probably a little late in picking up on that. Tom Faust was just talking in my ear. He's back from vacation, and thank goodness my producer is. He just cited for me an article that The Hill just moved saying that the state of Massachusetts, the governor's office there, is suspending sending their National Guard troops to the border, as the president had requested to help patrol.
Who's going to wash the horses then? because that's what the National Guard's been doing. Who's going to repair the Jeeps?
Didn't know that.
Yeah, they haven't been doing anything at the border anyway, so bring them home.
We have a lot of response on both Facebook and Twitter. I really will try to get to some of that, but I would suggest you can keep track of that conversation yourselves and talk back and forth as we go through this show. All right, so the president spoke a little while ago. He did double down on in his tweets about this this morning, suggesting, he said, we don't want to become Germany, another shot across the bow. He said something that he said, children are being used by some of the worst criminals on earth as a means to enter our country. Has anyone been looking at this? He's tweeted a lot about this. But let's listen now to his own words, the statement he made about 2 hours ago.
Immigration is the fault and all of the problems that we're having, because we cannot get them to sign legislation. We cannot get them even to the negotiating table. And I say it's very strongly the Democrats' fault. They're obstructing. They're really obstructionist, and they are obstructing. The United States will not be a migrant camp, and it will not be a refugee holding facility. Won't be. We want safety and we want security for our country. If the Democrats would sit down instead of obstructing, we could have something done very quickly. Good for the children, good for the country, good for the world. It could take place quickly. We could have an immigration bill. We could have child separation. We're stuck with these horrible laws. They're horrible laws. What's happening is so sad, and it can be taken care of quickly, beautifully, and we'll have safety. But just remember, a country without borders is not a country at all. We need borders. We need security. We need safety. We have to take care of our people. You take a look at the death and destruction that's been caused by people coming into this country without going through a process. And they could be murderers and thieves and so much else.
All right. So, Jim, first of all, there's the campaign kickoff speech, murderers, thieves, and so much worse, which is interesting that he would conjure up those images again at this point. But the other thing is this. Trump is saying it's the Democrats' fault because he cannot get a vote, assuming there's a bill that that comes to the floor. Republicans can't pass this through the entire Congress entirely on their own. They're going to need Democrats, certainly, in the Senate. But they can't bring enough Republicans together to pass the bill.
Right. Look. Number one, there were a couple things with Mr. Trump's statement there. Number one, yes, this is a problem that can be solved quickly and safely, simply with a phone call from him to Jeff Sessions. I mean, that's the truth of it. And then secondly, what he's got, he is trying to drive Democrats to the table rather than lure them to the table. And when you do that, I think what we're finding in this polarized situation, the political situation, is that actually exacerbates the situation. It doesn't make it better.
The last time I checked, the Republicans control the U.S. House of Representatives. The Republicans control the U.S. Senate. The Republicans control the White House. It's not something I'm terribly happy about, but it's a fact. And we know that in the House, where there are no filibuster threats or anything like that, the Republicans can't get their own majority together to pass anything. So to blame this on Democrats is absurd.
I do think there's a couple of points there. Number one, the timing of all this seems a little bit. Paul Ryan does have a bill in the House moving. There was a attempt at a bill in the Senate in the fall, and we could not get beyond the votes of the Republican Party on it. And Senator Schumer made it very clear that there were going to be no Democratic votes. So it's accurate to say that the Republicans have a majority in the Senate. The Republicans do not have control of the Senate. It takes 60 senators to control the Senate.
Well, that was my point.
Well,
right.
But keep in mind, there were 54 senators who voted for an immigration bill in the Senate.
That's right. Almost all Republicans.
No, that was all the Democrats and six Republicans, including Johnny Isaacson, that voted for a bill that gave Trump his wall in return for ultimately green card status for DACA kids. It was a straight-up trade. 54 senators supported it. The ones that voted against it were Democrats. I mean, Republicans. But the reality is there aren't enough Republicans to pass either the bill sponsored by the chair of the Immigration Subcommittee in the House or Ryan's bill. They're just not going to get them. So they're going to have a vote here, and it's going to go down in flames. Every Democrat will vote against it. No, maybe one or two might not, but most will vote against it. And they're going to lose 20 to 30 Republicans on each of these bills. And it wouldn't surprise me if, because of that, we end up getting three more Republicans to sign on to the petition to have a vote on the floor of a compromise bill, which would be a Democrat-Republican bill.
Did the time not run out on the discharge petition?
They can renew it at any point.
I don't know about the procedure. Up to the 25th of June. Yeah. June they have, so they can renew it, and maybe that's Paul Ryan's great strategy. I don't have any idea, but it's not going to pass.
And for our listeners, right, you think about the tactical strategy of what's going on here. It's not just the children, although that's the highlighted issue of the last 72 hours in the nation.
But the president put them front and center.
I mean, my point is, let's add it all up, though. The president's building his negotiating arsenal, right? DACA is being held up. Temporary protected status of every country that had temporary protected status has now been lapsed, right, on the table. And now this, right? Well, you can see, I don't agree with it, but the reality is you can see what he's doing. He's building his negotiating and trying to bring every lever to the table, because in New York real estate and in foreign policy with North Korea and others, he's been the disruptor, and that's what he's doing here. And in his mind, he's not treating people inhumanely to do this, although I think the majority of the nation probably disagrees with this.
Well, he's even got his wife saying that it's breaking her heart to see this policy.
And it is, and in his argument back, although I don't like making the argument for Donald Trump, is it's heartbreaking what's happening at the border every day prior to this. And so let's do this in order to force the compromise in the Senate.
All right,
but the problem with this as a negotiating strategy for this particular president is that he's likely to say one thing 1 minute, and then an hour or two later, he says something else. So if I'm a Republican in particular, and it's not often that I feel sorry for Republicans, but in this case I do. if I'm a Republican, I don't know what to believe when he says something, because then he goes on Fox and Friends an hour or two later and says something else. So this may well be a negotiating ploy, but I don't think that the man enjoys very high levels of trust among the members of Congress, Democratic or Republican, with whom he's trying to negotiate.
So, he's already said he would not sign the compromise bill. And then they had to
walk that one back.
All right, so let's.
But he didn't. His staff did.
So, Jim, as Beth pointed out, this is Political Rewind. Let's talk about this this week in the U.S. House. And Heath can weigh in, but I want to give you the first shot at this. I don't see how Republicans facing midterm elections. This is going to be like a draw in the World Cup. Maybe you'll win a point, but you're not going to have a clear victory, because either the bills go down in defeat, which gives you the chance to go to your constituents and say, oh, well, I tried, but I couldn't bring enough people along with me. And maybe that gets you to the draw. But you're also going to face constituents who say, why did you even try in the first place? You know we're opposed to any immigration. The core. I just don't see how Republican incumbents who are determined, especially because of the, through the discharge petition, to take this up, are going to win.
And especially where in races where you've still got Republican contests. I don't think that's not anywhere in Georgia at this point. I think all the congressional runoffs are on the Democratic side. But elsewhere, yeah, that's going to matter.
Heath, this would never even come to the floor, I don't imagine, and you'll weigh in. I don't think the speaker was dying to take up immigration legislation, but he was trying to fight off this discharge petition, which would have brought an even more egregious, from conservative Republicans' point of view, bill to the floor.
Well, and some argue that still may be the end play, right, is to get a compromise bill on the floor. But you have to go through the motions of having everything else defeated in order to do that. Paul Ryan and others in the Senate have been working on various versions of compromise legislation for the listeners in the state of Georgia, it's the compromise is the Isaacs and Chambliss legislation from 2006, right? And a lot of what the president is even proposing on border security was already in that legislation that was defeated by Republicans at the end of the day because it was
and put together with the help of Edward Kennedy.
That's right, because of the imagery of Ted Kennedy, right? It's hard to argue that he was compromising, but he was in that scenario. And then the next version of it was killed by the Democrats because what happens is both parties at the end of the day use this as a wedge issue in the election. So the fact this is happening in election year is terrible for those of us who want good policy on it because at the end of the day, both parties use it for fundraising and they don't want the issue solved.
So you and Chuck Cook disagree on a lot at this table today, but Chuck is nodding vociferously on this
Absolutely agree. It's been happening for years.
In fact,
Obama voted against that bill in 06 and 07 as well. So there was not just Republicans who voted against that bill.
Exactly, on both ends.
And Kevin McCarthy, I think that was as recently as in May, was in a private House Republican caucus, told his members that if they vote on the immigration, any vote on immigration reform would hand the speakership over to Nancy Pelosi.
Chuck, one of the things that strikes me before we move on to another subject is this weekend, looking at the video of children being taken from their parents. Yes, it's heartbreaking. We know that. It's bringing us close up and personal to a policy issue that, as we've already said, has been batted around for years, never gets anywhere. But it strikes me you see the personal side of this.
Well, I see this every day for years.
What is that like for you?
It is demoralizing, but at the same time, it makes you angry enough to fight. When you see the consequence of kids who have been separated from their mom and dad, there is long-term mental health harm that comes from that, that you cannot justify by anything saying it's just a short period of time. You've seen the pictures of the child wailing, the two-year-old, as his mom is being frisked in front of them, where there's policies in detention where they're not allowed to touch the kids. Not touching a kid has consequences. I mean, not cuddling a kid, not calming a child. These have serious long-term consequences. Seeing the human face of this helps you better understand, one, why people flee, why they're willing to go through this potential nightmare, but also that we desperately need a solution. We desperately need politicians from both parties who don't act in crisis, but who act in good faith to come up with a solution that actually makes this work for the people seeking refuge and works for the United States of America. We have an economic and societal interest in having a solution here. And we have no politicians willing to make the effort to make that. Well, very few politicians willing to make that happen.
Beth, we talked earlier about the morality of this, the optics of it. David Frisell, I hope I'm saying your last name right, David, sends us a message saying the North Georgia Conference of the United Methodist Church has just completed their annual conference and issued a very strong statement the separation of children from their parents. That's why I think in some ways this is a bridge too far. When you're going to have faith-based organizations, religious organizations speak out as adamantly as they're starting to, I don't see how in the long run it just strikes me that the president's going to have to rethink at least how he talks about this, if nothing else.
Or perhaps think about how he talks about it before he rethinks how he talks about it. I think you're absolutely right. The unfortunate reality is that we are in such an incredibly polarized period. There's a great op-ed piece by the Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg in the New York Times today, based on some national polling, looking at the polarization of both Democrats and Republicans. And the bases of both parties are just, they're off the deep end in terms of who they're going to vote for in the fall. And how they feel about the Trump administration, and the Republican Party is the Trump Party, and he enjoys very high approval ratings among his base. Every time the president says or does something outrageous, which is more frequently than many of us can handle, but every time he does that, the Democrats become even more loathsome of him, if sometimes that's possible. And it's just really hard to see how in this atmosphere that we're going to get people together, because there are good people in the Congress. Johnny Isaacson certainly is one of them. There are Democrats who are talking to Republicans across the aisle, trying to forge solutions. But I don't know how you're going to get enough votes in either chamber to get anything meaningful and effective passed.
All right, Jim, we got to move on, but I want to give you the last word before we take a break. I didn't mean to catch you off guard.
No, but it's just what can you say here is I'm waiting for a Republican to stand up, an elected Republican to stand up and say, no, this is wrong and has to go.
Well, you have Susan Collins standing up.
I think you'll have the Senator Isaacs and the other senators as the week goes on start to make it clear that they support the policy that does not separate the family.
Are you saying you didn't appreciate Susan Collins' statement?
No, she wrote a letter to her constituents saying she supports this.
No, she spoke out against the separation.
No, she spoke out against it, but she wrote a private letter to constituents.
Oh, that's news.
She and Jeff Flake are asking questions about the procedure.
Right.
But it's hard to find a Republican. And look, I look forward to Johnny Isaacson coming out on this.
I think the way, first of all, I mean, you know, these senators, the ones that are actually do good work, they're going to try to understand what the law is. There's a lot of information out there on both sides. They're going to be talking to everybody before they come out and make a declarative statement because they you know, this did kind of hit everybody. It's all of a sudden a new issue. That's out there. And so I think that they're going to do that. And you'll see a lot of Republicans saying, we got to figure out a way not to separate these families. That doesn't mean the White House will agree with them by any stretch, because I do think this is a part of a larger negotiating strategy on their part. And it is going to cause some real heartache for some real Republicans because the base is different from where independent voters are on this.
I got to interrupt. Okay, all of you out there in Twitter land and Facebook land, you are all saying that I'm wrong, that Susan Collins did not stand up, as you said,
told
Chuck
you.
Cook. So, hey, I mean,
she's the kind of person you would expect to stand up.
I get things wrong. What, 15, 20, 30%? Beth Shapiro.
Rarely. You've never been wrong. Denise tells me that you're never wrong.
That's right, my wife. Let's get a break in. When we come back, let's change subjects, Jim. Although, interestingly, it really is a good transition. Let's talk about a very big sea change in the Southern Baptist Convention. We'll do that after this break.
On the next Fresh Air, John Prine talks about his life and music. His new album, The Tree of Forgiveness, is his first in 13 years. Prine's first album came out in 1971 when he was just 24 and working as a mailman. Several of those songs became classics, including Angel from Montgomery, Sam Stone, and Paradise. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
We're back. Immigration lawyer Charles Chuck Cook is with us. Beth Shapiro, Heath Garrett, because it's Monday, and Jim Galloway from the AJC. You have given us so much to think about on Facebook Live and Twitter. As I said, today's not a day we're going to get to a lot of your comments. So I just urge you, all of you, to go there, share ideas, and maybe what we'll do is look them over and talk about them on Wednesday's show, share some of what you had to say today. Jim, the Southern Baptist Convention, as you mentioned earlier in the show, was in Dallas for their annual conference last week, and something extraordinary happened. We suddenly have new, more progressive leadership. And things are headed in a whole new direction. You know that organization well, so help us understand.
Okay, all right. Their president, I'm not calling his name right now, but is the youngest president that they've ever elected. They had vice president come and speak, and that's not that hasn't been unusual in the last 10, 20 years. But what preceded it were four votes to try to at least to either disinvite him, or to at least say that the Southern Baptist Convention isn't a political body. You had Paige Patterson, who was a seminary president, and who was one of the architects of the shift of the Southern Baptist Convention from what we used to call moderate to fundamentalist. He was disinvited from a speaking position because of accusations of how he had treated the claims of a rape claim at one of his seminaries. Yes. And another architect of the shift of that occurred started in the 80s, Paul Pressler, has been sidelined with a sexual harassment accusation. So this is I will tell you what, this is interesting, Bill, because when I started at the shortly after I started at the AJC, this would be 30 years ago, when the Southern Baptist Convention started, they started to purge moderates in favor of biblical inerrantists. There was a big push to treat the Bible as inerrant and infallible. That preceded it for the last three decades or so. The Southern Baptist Party has preceded the trend of the Republican Party, and you'll recall that back in 1980. The Southern Baptist leaders pretty much dumped Jimmy Carter, who they had supported in 76, and went to Ronald Reagan, presaging kind of the white evangelical shift over that way.
Yes, exactly. And
what this tells me that there's an expiration date on what Republicans are doing.
Well, that's what I think is fascinating. So, first of all, the new president of the SBC is a 45-year-old pastor. His name is J.D. Greer. He's from North Carolina. And his platform was, and I'm quoting now, a new culture and a new posture in the Southern Baptist Convention. Among other things, the convention, that Patterson-Pressler moved to the right, Heath, you're nodding, urged that Southern Baptists had to lovingly submit to their husbands, that they were not allowed to hold positions of office within the convention. They were prohibited from being treated as equals. And this year, under new leadership, they are saying it is time to give women their due, to say they are equal partners in the relationships. They've embraced the Me Too movement. This is a remarkable transformation, and it will have political implications down the road.
I definitely think it will. I think we're going to conflate the faith-based community support for Republicans and everything that the Southern Baptist Convention has. I'm an evangelical Methodist. I'm a proud Republican. I'm a proud free market conservative. And I've had issues with the Southern Baptist Convention's, folks who are trying to, overstate what the Bible does or doesn't say at given times. Most of my family are Southern Baptists. I have a lot of respect. 99% of these folks are going to church every day, trying to live their lives. Most of my family were Democrats, still are, and they're Baptists. So I do think that it coincides with the evangelical movement into the Republican Party over that period of time. But I think there's a real hostility towards people of deep faith in the Democratic Party in the modern era, too, which has contributed to that as much. So I don't want to let that off the hook. I also think it's also very similar to the mainline denominations are losing population rapidly.
But before we go there, doesn't this, Beth, the question that many anti-Trump people have been asking for a very long time is, how are the evangelicals, given all of Trump's alleged transgressions, sticking with this guy? You now, as Jim pointed out earlier, have Franklin Graham, Billy Graham's son, speaking out against the separation of children. You have the Southern Baptist Church saying we have to look more progressively at political issues. Maybe there is a chink in the evangelical armor in terms of their unanimous support for Trump.
Well, it may also be the case that, as often happens in social movements, some of the self-proclaimed leaders, the folks who have access to the White House, may be preaching a little bit different gospel than what their followers are following. And I think this is an encouraging sign coming out of the Southern Baptist Convention meeting. Time will tell. We'll see what starts to happen at the polls in terms of how evangelical voters vote. We'll see what happens in polling over the years.
What's interesting about the Southern Baptist Convention, it is probably the most thoroughly Democratic denomination in the U.S. It is, I mean, it is. You have congregations that act by on a majority rule, and then you have. Then you have an annual convention of messengers, and they all act by majority rule. It is, I mean, Robert's Rules of Order is secondary to the Bible, but it's still, but it is still very, very important.
That will never change.
Chuck, you pointed out that. And Heath already alluded to it, the diminishing attendance at church. Baptisms in Southern Baptist churches, 70-year low. Attendance in Sunday services, a 20-year low. Southern Baptist churches have lost 80,000 members in over a period of just a year, and many, many more over a decade.
Well, this is a trend in society. Many churches are losing members. A lot of millennials aren't going to church anymore. The only segment of Christianity that's growing in America are Latinos. Latino growth among churches, and all you do is drive around Georgia and look for every big giant church, and there's gonna be a little sign at 11 o'clock on Sunday, la misa en español, and so they have something in Spanish or Korean or another language. Immigrants are growing churches, but white people aren't. And I think what they're seeing is, how do we get people to come back or to stay in our church? And I think this is a reaction to that.
Which makes the national immigration debate so interesting, because the Republicans are just pushing away a population who, by many rights, in terms of positions on some of the issues
of the day,
would naturally be Republican, but because of national politics, it's going to be hard to attract Latinos
to
the party.
Yeah, there's and Bill, as far as the numbers, the decline in numbers, that's a very, very long term trend of the Southern Baptists.
Right.
But there is that parallel with Republican Party, where for decades the Southern Baptist reaction was, well, we just need to become more conservative, more intense in our decisions about women and faith.
Yeah. All right. We are
that's changing.
We are completely out of time for today. We did not get to the Supreme Court, although we can say they punted on partisan gerrymandering. Yeah. We'll talk about it on Wednesday's show, absolutely, and with a certainty. So my thanks to Chuck Cook. We always love having you
come
in and talk about immigration, among all the other things you can talk about. Beth Shapiro, Heath Garrett, Jim Galloway, thank you for being here. We are back Wednesday at 2. And then I want to tell you very quickly, you know, if you're an old timer like I am, I really hope you'll listen to Two-Way Street on Thursday. We're doing a show about one of the great, great Georgia songwriters, Johnny Mercer. And if you don't think you know Johnny Mercer's name, you may not. But when you start hearing the songs that man wrote, you will recognize a great many of them. It's a fun show to do, and I hope you'll join us for that. So, back on Political Rewind on Wednesday, Two-Way Street on Thursday, and Political Rewind again on Friday. And remember, on July 23rd, Monday, July 23rd, we kick into our four-day-a-week schedule. I'm going to the gym right now to start working out for that. Thanks for being here, everybody. See you again on Wednesday.